and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, February 18th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This week, Rabble continued its coverage on the Ottawa occupation, beginning with the news of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoking the Federal Emergencies Act. But there is much more going on in Ottawa. The Trudeau government is making important updates to Canada's Environmental Protection Act, though the opposition argues existing loopholes are weakening the bill. And finally, there is a hierarchy in healthcare. Free availability of proper masks would go a long way to ease the burden of remaining healthy, Evelyn Lazare argues. We'll dive into all those stories and more a bit later on our show. First, Libby Davies interviews Paul Taylor. They talk about how the pandemic has affected his nonprofit, including reevaluating self-care days. He also explains how activists should allow for room for fatigue and frustration during difficult times. Paul Taylor is the executive director of FoodShare Toronto and a lifelong anti-poverty activist. He also teaches at Simon Fraser University and has written numerous op-eds and columns on a variety of social issues. In 2020, Paul was named one of Canada's top 40 under 40. He's also one of Toronto Life's 50 most influential Torontonians and voted as best activist by Now magazine readers. Libby Davies is the author of Outside In, a political memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015 and is former NDP deputy leader and house leader. Libby's also a recipient of the Order of Canada. Here are Paul and Libby in conversation. Take a listen.
Well, hello, Paul Taylor. It's wonderful that you could join me today and that we can have this conversation. I, as you know, I'm a big fan of yours and what you do there in Toronto, and what you do ripples across the country, I have to tell you. And it makes it all the way to the West Coast where you used to be. I remember when you worked at the West End Neighborhood House. So yes, your voice comes all the way over to the West Coast. I want to begin by saying, you know, it's been a tough 2 years for people, especially for people who, even in the best of times, are vulnerable and at risk. And I'd like to get your thoughts for the coming year. Specifically, what issues and concerns are key for the people and the movements that you work with?
Oh, I love that question. You know, and I'm going to dive right in because I actually think that's a really important question. But before I even dive into that, actually, I want to acknowledge something that isn't often acknowledged. And it's that, you know, people aren't vulnerable. I've really come to believe, you know, they've been made vulnerable by harmful systems, institutions, public policies, and ultimately oppressive organizing principles like capitalism, colonialism, and white supremacy. So when it comes to, you know, what issues and concerns people have been raising, I've seen an important, and I would even offer an essential shift, you know, that excites me. You know, people might be experiencing poverty or food insecurity, but to an increasing degree, I'm seeing, you know, a number of movements, individuals, and organizations are recognizing what's at the core of these issues. And it's in fact those oppressive organizing principles, you know, things like white supremacy and ableism. And charity and even social movements might be mobilized, you know, along the lines of those symptoms, poverty, food insecurity, homelessness. But increasingly, what excites me is that we're recognizing the need to work together to demonstrate our collective power to push back against these root causes. And I think that work starts in our movements, our organizations, our workplaces, and certainly our own homes.
I find that very interesting when you talk about how it's very easy for us to work in different silos, and you speak about how important it is to find connections and work together. What are the things that you do to facilitate that and to help make that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, for example, when FoodShare responded to the pandemic and partnered with a bunch of 100 organizations and groups across the city to, you know, provide some emergency support to folks, we said, yeah, we're going to partner on emergency support, but let's work together to do what we can to kind of get to know each other, build relationships so that we can collectively work together to address some of the kind of public policy issues that we're all feeling are holding back the folks that we work with or harming the folks that we work with. So I think that for us, you know, organizing with groups that are already deeply connected and embedded with folks who have been made most vulnerable.
Does that organizing happen in a more informal way through the relationships that you develop with people and organizations? Or is it something that you consciously think about, strategize, and even plan for, like when you do your annual plan for food share?
Absolutely. It's something that we're deliberate about. It's something that, but we recognize we're very relational in this. So we're deliberate about building the relationships, but we're also deliberate about, you know, sharing information and drawing attention to issues, campaigns that are of importance to folks that we're working with. So we work really closely, for example, with Gig Workers United. And right now we're doing all that we can to help draw attention to the issue that they're helping draw attention to, which is that the attack on gig workers and essentially all workers. So those sorts of things, thinking about how we can challenge the silos and support each other with information sharing, but also with tangible supports.
It's one thing to develop those relationships and foster that strength of solidarity with your allies. How do you approach that when you are having to interact with other public agencies or even different levels of government, City of Toronto, the province, government departments and agencies? Do you have different strategies about how you build those kinds of relationships and even alliances with them?
I would say yes and no. No, in that we approach it bravely and honestly, as we do with our community partners, as we do with even our donors. And then in terms of how we build alliances, certainly we're building relationships with folks within those institutions. And we also recognize that sometimes within those institutions or folks within those institutions are really limited in terms of what they can say. So often it's really thinking about how can we help push and move the dial as a group that's operating from outside of the institution. And I think that's been really key, building those relationships and doing it in a way that recognizes that we're not going to agree on everything, but the things that we agree on, let's lend our energies to working to advance those. And the things that we don't agree on, we can still disagree and even argue about them. But in this space, in this moment, we have an opportunity to focus on something that we agree on. And I found that to be very helpful, not just with, you know, large institutions or folks connected to large institutions, but even some of our funders, some of our partners who may worry that they can't speak out in a way that maybe we can. We don't get a lot of provincial dollars. So, you know, a lot of other organizations are worried about putting those dollars at risk. We really approach this bravely and honestly and maintaining our accountability, I think, where it belongs. And it's to people who experience food insecurity and poverty. And if we're not being brave on their behalf and alongside them, we're not doing the work.
The last 2 years have been difficult for people. Has the pandemic changed the way you have worked, both with the people that you're, I don't want to use the word clients, but the people that you're there to support and to empower, but also with, you know, the different organizations and even governmental organizations? Has the pandemic changed that in any way, those working relationships?
It did in a kind of way. You know, FoodShare has never distributed free food. It has not been a part of our model. We really focus on building community or resident-led in food infrastructure. So, you know, setting up markets. We've helped set up 50 produce markets across the city. We've turned underutilized public land into urban farms owned by community, not by FoodShare. And for us, it was a bit of a shock and pivot to say, okay, you know, we've got these good food boxes that we're selling to generate revenue for our programs. And we're also hearing that food banks are 40% of food banks across the city of Toronto were forced to close at the onset of the pandemic. So for the first time in FoodShare's history, we were actually partnering with organizations and saying, let's use our trucks to deliver fresh produce to people in this moment. And we've done that throughout the pandemic. We continue to do that. But I think we've also been intentional about, you know, using this as an opportunity to build relationships with new groups, getting to know what their needs are, and thinking about how we can further leverage our capacity to support their aims and the communities that they work alongside.
I think one of the outcomes of the pandemic is that people are really weary. You know, it's been a long haul. And for you and the folks and the communities that you work with, your focus is, as you said, making change. So I'm very curious to know your take on what it is that we can do to keep people energized and engaged. What can we do to support each other as we work for change, as we continue to go through this pandemic, and who knows what's beyond and what permanent changes are? There is no normal, you know. First of all, normal was never normal for the most people. Exactly. But how do we keep people energized and engaged and support each other?
You know, you're going to be able to tell that I was that kid in school that was often pushing boundaries, because I'm going to kind of flip this as I think about this, flip this on its head a little bit. So bear with me. I think we can't keep people energized, engaged, and perhaps we shouldn't always try. And I think that might be where some movements fail, because I see the roots of that kind of thinking that many of us have embraced in capitalism. Keep going. Don't stop. I think what might be more sustaining and people-centered is designing our movements and organizing in a way that really allows people to tap out, to rest, to recharge, and then to rejoin if and when they're ready. You know, I recognize that I may not see all of the change that I hope for in my lifetime, but, you know, I've come to realize that if I've helped make it so that the work and the organizing for change can continue beyond my lifetime, then I can be really proud of having done so. I'd feel good knowing that, you know, I'm holding the baton alongside people that are rested and seizing opportunities for joy. And I want the same for the people that will all pass the baton along to, that they're rested, they're engaging with joy. And I think that's one of the things that I think about my ancestors. What they, I imagine, would have loved to have me do is enjoy rest and peace. So I think that's something that we've got to build into our movements, recognize that we're not always going to be engaged and energized throughout the process, but we can design for that.
You know, that's really very refreshing to hear, because I think when people are engaged in movements for change, there is this sense of determination, and we have to be relentless and we do have to keep going. So the idea that it's more of a relay race and we can mm-hmm. pass the baton, that we are part of a team and that we can take turns, mm-hmm. you know, and still get to the finish line, wherever that finish line might be or when it might be. So I think that's a really lovely way to approach it. And in mm-hmm. terms of your own organization, what does that look like? I mean, have you made changes to accommodate people because people are feeling burned out and they do need to take time out and take rest?
Absolutely. We've increased the number of personal days available to folks from 3 to 10. My colleagues we all have 20 paid sick days, and we've changed the language from sick days to sick/wellness days, where you don't have to even explain to your supervisor what's going on, if you've got a cold or if you just need to prioritize your wellness, which might mean, you know, a day of Netflix and a takeout. You know, that's all really important. And that's part of, you know, taking care of ourselves. So I think we've done a number of things like that, making things like headspace at work available for folks to be able to really prioritize the things that we need to be able to do work well. And I think for us, we really think about this as pushing back on grind culture, capitalism-induced grind culture that will squeeze every last bit of juice out of us in service of whatever we're in service of, whether it's profit in a corporation or a mission and vision in a nonprofit. But what we're doing is we're still harming people. So I've been so proud that my colleagues and I, we seize those opportunities to make sure that we're finding joy, we're getting rest. Folks that are, as a result of the pandemic, that have been forced to provide, you know, care and work at the same time. You know, last year we introduced, I think, over 20 paid care days. This year we're already up to 15 paid care days. And, you know, I think that's the type of thing that happens when we see people as not just workers, but as people who are nurturing families and communities. And we need to take care of those folks as well.
How do you share that changed workplace culture? You're doing it in your organization. I can imagine that you are getting very good responses, and you can, you know, maybe there are even things that you're doing to measure how it's producing a better workplace. But how are you able to reach beyond that to share that kind of success story? How can we get that word out there?
You know, I have to tell you, about every day, it's rare that I don't receive an email from somebody that works at or runs an organization across the country that is either reaching out to say, we've helped inspire change within their organization and they share the change, or they want to strategize with us around making the case for change. And how do we get that information out? You know, we've really wrestled with this at the beginning because we don't want to make other organizations feel like they are inadequate or they're not doing the right thing. But we realize that, you know, actually what's more important is to inspire possibility. So we, you know, seize opportunities to share some of the things that we're doing that other folks, other organizations may not have thought as possible. You know, we went from, and it's been a journey, so we speak to it very honestly. You know, we went from, we were an organization where our lowest paid worker was paid $12 an hour. You know, now our lowest paid worker is paid $24 an hour, living wage in Toronto being $22.08. You know, that took hard work, and we share that journey and what that looked like with folks. But even more than the hard work, it took a commitment to living our values. And I think that's the thing that we're trying to help the sector realize, that living our values is not just what we're doing out in communities, it's how we're doing it. And like I say, that work starts at home, that work starts in our organizations and in the spaces that we exist.
I think it's easy to say that, and it's really hard to do. You know, my experience is that there are so many amazing, very small nonprofits, and the resources that they have, even, you know, the lack of capacity that they have to take on, to even time to reflect, to think about this stuff, because they're always, you know, under a deadline. It's really hard. So I think it's very affirming to hear that you think about it and you do it and you share what you're doing and help other people, organizations, you know, show the path that it can be done. So people don't have to learn from, you know, zero.
It's so true. And I have to tell you, that's one of the questions I get pretty often is how do we do it when we have such limited resources and we're trying to do this and this and this? And I say, well, that's grind culture. You can't do everything. You can't do this and this and this and this. If you're not able to do it in a sustainable way that prioritizes you and your colleagues, well, then you've taken on too much. And you maybe need to think about, we've got to do less, because we're causing the same kind of harm that's being caused out there by capitalism and all those forces that have long caused harm to folks.
Very difficult questions to grapple with, for sure. Well, you know, FoodShare has always been on the forefront of grassroots service and change in Toronto. And you've just demonstrated that by some of the experiences that you shared with us. And I am interested, and I know the listeners will be interested to know what this year, 2022, looks like for this very key NGO in Toronto. That you lead. You're the leader. I know you probably have a very flat model and you're very empowering, but I think people see you as a leader. So love to hear your wisdom of what does 2022 look like for you guys? And what are you anticipating? The good and the bad and the ugly.
Well, you know, this is, I wish I had like a beautiful, exciting answer to share, but really we're going to continue to prioritize and do all that we can to support folks working for change, whether they're my colleagues and the internal work that we've been focused on, or whether it's the support for local groups and community-based mutual aid initiatives or under-resourced social movements. I think, you know, if as an organization, we can use our resources and our infrastructure to support their work, they're organizing or they're living, you know, in ways that make sense to them, then hopefully we're freeing folks up to do some of that rest, some of that recharging that needs to happen. And of course, allowing them to support themselves, their families, and their communities. And, you know, actually 2022, I've been thinking about it as we are well into 2022. And someone sent us a note recently, and I think they put it so beautifully. They thanked us for being angry and hopeful. And I think that's what we're going to continue to be, angry and hopeful.
A lot of people don't like to use the word angry, but I know from my old organizing days, I would always speak about anger because it's a great motivation. When you're pissed off and angry about something, it moves people to want to make change. But I think coupling that with the idea of hope and support is a very nice way to put it.
I love that you say that, because I was just having this conversation with someone the other day about how important it is to make space for anger and rage in our movements. Because, you know, especially when we think about people who have been made most vulnerable, of course, to expect them not to be angry or enraged is ludicrous, you know? And so I think we need to make space for those emotions in our work, because then we're truly making space for people who have been made most vulnerable by systems and institutions across this land.
Yes. Well, I mean, I totally agree with you, Paul. And for many people, that's how they get involved, right? Because they feel like they've got to do something because they've got to the point where they just can't take it anymore. So it's a very powerful motivation. And I think the challenge is to find the ways to support people so they can like deal with the anger and get into being proactive about and understand the power and voice that they have. And you guys are certainly doing that. It's wonderful to see. Well, I do want to thank you, Paul, for taking the time with us today. And I know the folks who listen to Rebel Radio across the country will be very interested. And I do think that, you know, 2022 is going to be another challenging year, but to hear what you're doing and what your organization FoodShare is doing in very, like, what I like is that you're very on the ground. You have both a big vision about who you are and what you do, but you're also very pragmatic. And that's, you don't always find that. It's sometimes one or the other. You somehow seem to have brought that together. So I certainly want to wish you well and say thank you very much for sharing time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. For you and for Rebel Radio, anytime. It was an absolute pleasure.
That was Paul Taylor in conversation with Libby Davies. Thanks so much for that, Paul and Libby. It's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Well, it's been 3 weeks now, and we're still talking about the occupation in Ottawa. Rabble has been at the forefront of news coverage and analysis as the story continues to unfold. The top story of this week was, of course, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's invoking of the Federal Emergencies Act on Monday, February 14. As Carl Nirenberg writes, it's been weeks and a seemingly impossible task has been to have Ottawa police remove illegally parked vehicles from the downtown core. And while some private towing companies have contracts with the city, they have refused to respect those contracts. A provision in the new Federal Emergencies Act allows authorities to, in effect, commandeer privately owned service providers, such as towing companies, and force them to provide their services. Trudeau's announcement made it clear. The Ottawa police were out of excuses for their failure to act. What seems to worry the occupiers more than the police are the financial penalties, Nirenberg reports. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland announced at Monday's news conference that truckers who persist in breaking the law could have their bank accounts frozen and their insurance policies suspended. Elsewhere on the site, Jim Stanford explains how the convoy has been overshadowing the real problems truckers face in their industry. It is well documented that the truckers' protest has little to do with trucking, he writes. Most vehicles in the convoy are not trucks. Most people at the protests are not truckers. And most of the organizers' demands, from opposing all COVID-19 health restrictions to removing the elected government of Canada, have nothing to do with trucking. Working truck drivers face many challenges. They are treated unfairly by employers, shippers, and governments. And many more issues are being ignored while the occupation goes on. Robin Brown explores the double standard in law enforcement in in his piece this week, drawing comparison to the American attack of the Capitol on January 6, 2021. He writes, "Just as people around the world remarked at how American police treated the Capitol attackers very differently from Black Lives Matter protesters, we saw how Ottawa police treated the truckers very differently from the young Black and Indigenous protesters who blocked an Ottawa intersection in November 2020, following the acquittal of Ottawa Police Constable Daniel Monson and the death of Abdi Rahman Abdi." Brown wasn't surprised to see the lack of response from the Ottawa Police Service. On the contrary, it was exactly as expected. He writes, "The Ottawa Police Service, like all police forces in Canada, has always had one mandate, protect the powerful, or at least don't get in their way. And the thousands of convoy protesters with their millions in the bank are the powerful. The young Black and Indigenous protesters who blocked the Ottawa intersection in November 2020 weren't." Also on the site this week, Evelyn Lazare argues for the right for free N95 masks for all Canadians. When one considers the cost of average COVID hospitalizations, not to mention COVID ICU hospitalizations, the cost of supplying every Canadian over the age of 18 with a face mask should be a no-brainer. Consider it new math, she writes. Finally, this week, Stephen Wenzel reports on updates to Canada's Environmental Protection Act. The proposed reform, Bill S-5, called Strengthening Environmental Protection for a Healthier Canada Act, was introduced on February 9th by Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Stephen Guilbeault, and will introduce the right to a healthy environment for the first time in a federal statute in Canada. Updates to the legislation will include requiring the Minister of Environment and Climate Change to annually report on the implementation of a framework for governments to protect people's right to a healthy environment. It will also create a new publicly available watch list of substances Canadians should avoid. It will also move to reduce, refine, or replace the use of animal testing. In addition to this, the federal government would renew their commitment to implement the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Despite these commitments to the new legislation, the opposition says it will make little to no difference. NDP environment critic Laurel Collins says, "The Liberals have made a lot of empty promises about protecting the environment and fighting climate change, but when it comes down to it, they fail to act." You can find the full version of each of these stories and much more on rabble.ca. And before we sign off this week, I want to share some exciting news. Rabble was recognized as Best Community News Website at the Canadian Online Publishing Awards this past week, winning silver in the category. Congratulations to Rabble's team and to all our listeners and readers. And that's it for our show this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Paul Taylor and Libby Davies for their interviews this week. Thank you to Carl for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.